there's big issues in the States with people having so many consumer goods that they're putting them in storage units. Like it's another face of obesity. It's another face of this hunger. It's an insatiable, bottomless pit that objects or food are supposed to fill. I think they can only be filled by connection with other humans.
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today on The Public, we're speaking with the new director of the English section of the National Theatre School, Alisa Palmer, about gluttony, social contract, and acting. Born and raised in New Brunswick, Alisa Palmer studied history at McGill in addition to her education across the spectrum of theatrical arts. She studied Bouffant, which is a mocking style of comedy, Masque Neutre, which is the highly physical style performed while wearing a neutral mask, and acrobatics at none other than the Cirque du Soleil. She's taught in conservatories and universities right across the country, and recently completed her 8th season at the Shaw Festival. In October of last year, Alisa Palmer was named the new director of the National Theatre School's English section, and she took over that post in January of this year. Here to speak with us about herself, the National Theatre School, and the role of the dramatic arts in our YouTube age is Alisa Palmer. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael.
I gave you a very cursory introduction to your education and your career. Would you please elaborate on that and tell us about the high points, the low points, the formative moments in your personal trajectory?
That's a good start. Well, the things you said are true. I'll start with that.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it.
And some of them were the high points. I had a really eclectic training. I remember sitting my parents down. I was a teenager. I'd just been graduating from my BA doing history. In fact, I did the philosophy of history. In fact, that's historiography for the nerds out there. And historiography is the exploration of narrative, who creates history, subjectivity versus the objectivity that's implied in the study of history. So it's all related to theater. All of that stuff will come around. So I was just finishing my degree in that specific field, and I remember sitting my parents down on a ferry ride when they used to have a ferry from New Brunswick to Prince Edward Island, and now they have a bridge. So we were on the ferry, and I remember breaking it to them that I wanted to have a methodology. That's what I wanted when I grew up, that I wasn't going to go to law school. Instead, I was going to find a methodology. And I remember them looking at me, the wind blowing their hair back, and they had sort of blank expressions on their faces. Shocked by, like, what does this mean? And what I meant was I was going to go around, find mentors, apprentice myself to people, attach myself to people who had developed ways of creating theater. And that included some of these physical methodologies you were talking about. It included working on improvisation via Keith Johnstone, doing Theater of the Oppressed with Augusto Boal, who's a teacher and theater creator in Brazil and Argentina and Paris. He lived around the world, studying with Eugenio Barba, who developed Odin Teatret in Denmark. A number of different forms of theater that involve physical creation, creation with text. And then I studied with a lot of great artists from English Canada, including Jackie Maxwell, who runs the Shaw Festival, and that sort of opened a door for me being interested in that material, and connected really well back to my history degree, because they do a lot of period work and theater from period of time. So those were some of, that's how it sort of started. So I was working in Quebec, studying movement forms, and then I would be able to be employed as sort of an exotic theater creator in Toronto, because English Canada doesn't have a lot of Quebec-trained feminist theater artists at that time.
Very exotic.
It was very exotic. So I came to English Canada via my training in French-based, European-based theater techniques, and the combination of all the methodologies that I was collecting got me the opportunity to be invited into Collective Creations in Toronto. And from there, I started to understand what directing was as its own special field, and that became my big love. So, but I had to start that via creating my own work. I wrote a play called A Play About the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, which was based on some of my travels in Argentina. And I had my initial interest in theater was in trying to capture the voice of, well, I was interested in social change and in, like a lot of young people, like a lot of people, period, wanting to make change in the world. And I also loved what would be called high art, like really unusual visual forms, physical forms of theater, really demanding language. And I thought the two should go together, that political art should not be mutually exclusive terms, that all great art is political, it talks about power in the world, and all great political ideas can be artistically eloquent. So that was my goal, and that's sort of the soup that I started from. Once I decided I wanted to be a director and started creating my own pieces to get some visibility, then people started trusting me with their other works of art. And I was invited to direct shows by artists that had written plays, and then I was interested in doing classical work. So I came sort of through a back door of very obscure, specific forms like those you've mentioned.
So your training and your experience is perceived in Toronto as being exotic and welcomed as a result of that. But at the same time, you've been criticized for some of your more challenging perspectives. For instance, pointing out that none of the plays at one of the larger theater houses here in Toronto in an entire season were penned by women. How do you reconcile that, the exoticism versus the difference, or the otherism, I suppose, from your perspective?
Yeah. Now, were you saying that I've been criticized for which?
In an article in Rover magazine or online magazine, you mentioned that there was a theater house here in Toronto.
Well, that, I don't know, that's a good question how they are connected. It seems to be congruent to me. It seems like I'm interested in the marginalized point of view, and artists are often outsiders. And there's a beautiful distinct perspective when you're kind of an outsider and an insider. And identity is a shifting thing, you know, it's all relative to where you are. Like, I'm an outsider in some people's minds because I'm married to a woman, I'm in a lesbian relationship. But I'm an insider because I actually have a stable family and a home and children. So I'm both an outsider and very much part of the mainstream, depending on how you look at me or how I look at myself. So I consider those art forms to be quite obscure and distinct and special. So in some respects, I would be an outsider for that reason. But my sensibilities are really populist. I want to communicate to a lot of people, and I believe that people want to be engaged. And so in that respect, I'm very, very mainstream. So I like to imagine that a lot of people straddle this insider-outsider thing. And as an artist, I really like to cherish that double identity and that paradox. There's a lot of tension in that paradox, and it's a rich fountain of such is the case with the theater company that was asking me to stop complaining about their programming because I worked for them. I had a fantastic time working for them, and they do a lot of mainstream, what would be considered mainstream productions, of typical sort of classical work, of traditional repertoire of the classics and North American classics. And so I had a great time working with them and did shows that were successful there. But I was also doing work, I was doing work by women writers because they hadn't produced any. And so I just do what I always do, which is to speak my mind. And at some point they found that was, they didn't want me to do that. And for them, there's a contradiction. If somebody's working with them, I guess you're not supposed to point out anything critical.
Or, right.
Yeah. So I'm not saying anything that isn't public domain. You just look at their website, you can see what their programming is, and it's up for grabs. And my opinion shouldn't be a surprise. I ran Nightwood Theatre for many years, which is a feminist theatre company. So it seems self-evident to me. And it's normal for people to say, stop talking and complaining about things. That's okay. They're entitled to their opinion.
Well, recently you have been undergoing, or undertaking, I should say, an 11-city cross-Canadian audition tour for the National Theatre School and its acting program. Would you tell us about this audition tour, the process, the kinds of students you're looking for?
Oh, yeah, it's been really eye-opening. I'm right in the middle of it now. So I've been at the theatre school now in my capacity as artistic director of the English section for about 10 weeks. So it's a steep learning curve. And around this time of year, every year, they do a national audition tour because it is a national theater school. And so every artistic director will have their own way of doing that. And what I decided to do was to start in Winnipeg, which is the center of the country. And even though every city probably thinks they're the center of Canada, that's a healthy egoism that a lot of cities must have. But I started in the physical center in Winnipeg, and it's also a city where I've worked a number of times at the Manitoba Theatre Center and the Winnipeg Jewish Theatre, and it's a great theatre town. So I thought this is a good way for me to start. And I started there and went west to the coast, and going to Regina, Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver. And then I came back to Toronto, and I've just finished 4 days now. And then what lies ahead of me is going to Montreal, and then St. John's, Halifax, Fredericton, and Ottawa. So I'm right at the midpoint. So the idea I had for the audition tour was to have the auditions take place in theaters across the country, and to invite artistic directors of these theaters to sit with me and watch the auditioners, and partly because they would be able to provide context in areas where I don't know, and partly because I really want to get to know better the people who are running theaters across the country, the people who are doing the frontline hard work of getting the shows out, getting the culture strengthened and reinforced across the country, because that is you have to be indefatigable to do it, especially in this economic time. So I'm partnering with people across the country, finding out about those people and what they're doing across the country, because our students graduate into their arms. And I want all the English-speaking graduates to know that there are many places in Canada that are really important for them to go and work. It isn't just Toronto, or there are no assumptions about where they should go. There's many, many lively regions, and I want to get to know them firsthand. So what we're looking for, I'm basically open to anybody. And I sit in a room with a couple of colleagues, and whoever is coming through that door, we never know who it's going to be or what they're going to bring to the table. And all I'm looking for really is there's a kind of raw talent that is almost indescribable. It includes things like presence, gives me the feeling that I want to watch this person, that I'm engaged in something that they are communicating, transporting through their body. There's a story and a mystery to what they're doing. And I want to know more and see more. And they're drawing me and engaging me. So that's what I'm looking for. And it can take any form. It can be somebody who's very, very practiced and very experienced. Or it could be somebody who has never actually done any formal theater at all. That is immaterial to me. It's really about a willingness, attitude, and this spark that engages me and makes me feel engaged. Because that's the effect that we want to have as an audience.
You've said that you want to recruit students who have no plan B.
Yes.
What does that mean?
It kind of comes from my personal background and what I hear. I am a parent now. I have two children. And I remember growing up and hearing either amongst my friends or from my parents, perhaps myself, it's great that you want to go into the arts, but you need to have a plan B. You need to have a backup plan. And I've heard that phrase a lot for young people, right? It's great to have passions, but you need a backup plan, like some reasonable thing. And I take, it stayed in my mind, obviously, for so many years, but I take umbrage with it because for a couple of reasons. One is there's no career in the world that has any guarantee, A, of economic stability, or B, happiness. You can't know that. We can't control, we're foolhardy to think we can control either economic curves or even what our personalities are going to become as we age. So I think the plan B thing is a bit of a mug's game. It's fool's gold. You're not really going to find it. And I also think it has the unfortunate tendency to undermine somebody's passion. And the only value I can see in the phrase is that if somebody wants to be an artist and says to me, I know, and people have asked me, how do you become a director? And I sometimes will say to them, well, is there anything else you really, really want to do with your life? And if they say, yes, I really want to be a veterinarian, I would say, you should do that, because the only way you're really going to thrive is if you're obsessed. It's got to feel like the compulsion to express yourself artistically and to become a professional is got to feel as undeniable as sexuality or something like that. It's part of an identity. Because everyone has the right to express themselves. Everyone should. But not everybody is going to live as an artist, let alone a professional artist. So it's got to drive you. So from that point of view, I'm looking for the people who really don't have a backup plan. They're going to live this way, whether I'm going to let them in the theater school or not. They're going to do what they're going to do. And it'll be my good fortune if I can find them and I can invite them to join us. And I see people like that. I think they're going to do it anyway. They're going to do it. They're going to be who they are in the arts. That's what I mean.
And you're just hoping they'll do that. They'll accomplish those things in support of the National Theatre School and as an extension of the Canadian theatrical community and tradition. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot of people that are going to do it, whether they come to the theatre school or not. Like, some people are going to be artists and the conservatory training isn't the right place for them because of the things that they want to do. And some people, I'm looking for them as well, the ones that really this kind of training is going to be exactly what they need to open the doors to a long career or open their fire inside them and help them channel it and put it into technique. I'm very motivated at this time in my life to work at the school, because I know that I feel like in the arts we're having to kind of justify ourselves, like justify our existence, and we have to sometimes use these arguments about how much our art form produces in the economy. Like, we're having to respond to terms of the argument that are set by the business model. And I'm not opposed to business at all. I actually think science and arts and business, they're all part of the same endeavor, which is living well. But I think the terms of the argument, sometimes we're apologizing for our existence. And I like being with young people who could give a flying anything about the economic crisis. They want to be who they are and express who they are. And I'm jumping on that train to say, yeah, let's change the terms of the argument. Culture is part of who we are. It's our food. It's our nutrition. We become unwell as a civilization without art. And young people are the ones who will change the terms of the argument, because they come into it saying, well, of course I'm going to do this. I have to. You know, I see 300, 400 people who, for no good sensible reason, want to be actors. It's fantastic. It's great. It's because it has to be. Art has to be.
So you're throwing a very wide net to capture what you perceive as the most passionate, the most immediately communicative of Canada's theatrical youth, I'll call them, underdeveloped resource, I suppose I should say. And after auditions in, what was it, 5 cities so far, and 6 more to go, or thereabouts, you've seen 100 people across the Western Canada and 120 here in Toronto reportedly, and people come into the room where you're sitting waiting for them and you don't know what to expect. It all sounds a little like American Idol, or like, so you think you can dance. What do you think of that? And what do you think of that genre of entertainment as it informs our theatrical, our cultural, our artistic understanding?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, one of the distinctions about this experience, I think the analogy with a contest is a good, I mean, it's a fair analogy. One of the distinctions is that there's a level of simple kind of privacy. Like, there's no interview or YouTube or any other kind of stepping stone to this. Like, people can walk in the door and have had very little theater experience, and I can see something. I feel like I've been in the field long enough to be able to recognize the kind of beautiful mix of humility and megalomania that any kind of performing artist needs. And I'm also looking for people that are going to work in a conservatory context, and a very collaborative form. And so the contests on TV, the other distinction is that those aren't particularly collaborative forms. They're solo forms for the most part, unless it's a dance ensemble. And even then, it's a very specific form with quite explicit objective standards. Like singing a song, there are notes and a scale. There's some interpretation involved, obviously, but there are steps to a dance. There are criteria that are more or less objective that they have to meet. And at this point in the auditions, there are fewer objective standards, and I'm looking for somebody who's going to participate in a collaborative form. So it isn't just about their solo. It isn't exclusively about their solo excellence based on this criteria. It's actually about somebody who's at a time in their life with a certain set of skills and a certain je ne sais quoi, and all those factors together make this a different endeavor. And it is also, the other big distinction is we're not airing the reaction to their quote-unquote success or failure. And I think the power and the appeal of those reality shows are like kind of the gladiators in the Colosseum, where you're going to watch somebody fall. Like what they say about people go to the circus because they want to see the acrobat fall. And now we've gone to Cirque du Soleil, and we know that no one really does fall. They have too much expertise. But I think those shows feed off of a kind of prurient appetite for what kind of suffering and pain and anguish, and that's not part of this process at all. There's no exposure to of that. The individual's kind of sanctity is protected. It's private.
How do you think these audition shows that cultivate the American dream of the democratic access to global fame and fortune inform our culture's consumption of the arts?
Oh yeah, I think it puts into question what art is, and in some cases art can be confused with a narcissistic impulse, and it can also be confused with, I think that people have a hunger for being seen. And I think it's very natural. And I think it comes from infancy. Babies, when you feed babies, you look in their eyes and they need that to grow. Like they've done studies with infants where they'll feed an infant a certain amount of nutrition, but without the certain physical contact. Or they've done this probably with animals.
I think probably not people, but no, I know, but they've done it with monkeys.
But they have studied children who are monkeys, yeah, as if they need to study this, right? They take away some of the nurturing aspects, and they find shockingly that the nutrition alone doesn't provide wellness. I know, who needs to study that? But they have looked at children who have experienced what is it called, failure to thrive. Failure to thrive is a condition that doesn't come from nutritional shortcomings. It comes from an absence of love, and part of love is being seen. So I think people and animals want to be seen. They want to be witnessed, and they want to experience eyes on them. And it isn't, I think it only becomes an unfortunate narcissistic endeavor when people are starved. And I think in our culture, there's a lot of starvation of attention and love and time. And I think that's where some of the obesity issues come from. Ironically, but kind of poignantly, I think people are yearning. So I have sympathy for the impulse to want to be on stage and be excellent, because I think it comes from a really honest hunger for love and attention. And I think that the shows or our culture, I think we kind of are putting a Band-Aid on it by saying, yeah, let's give lots of attention. People want attention, let's go for it. Let's make this contest. And they're trying to work. They're trying to make qualitative things quantitative by saying there's a winner and a loser, first place, second place, trying to find some formula to fit all this in. So I think the impulse of it all comes from the same place that art comes from, which is we want to hear stories, tell stories, be seen, witness things, and find our redemption in that connection. And the contests are kind of a fast food. They're fast food replacement for nourishment.
And for, you would describe or compare in the situation, nourishment to true culture and true theatrical expression.
Or even true, or even just authentic, not high art or low art, but actually telling a story and communicating a story and a story being received. And it can come in any form of theater or dance or performance, high, low, this class or that class, this style or that style. That is immaterial. It's like the people I see walking in the room. It's not the external form of them. It's actually, there's kind of an essence of an ability to engage and communicate. And that's what makes something authentic culture.
What do you think of the appropriation of these ideally authentic means of expression for marketing purposes? I'm thinking of United Breaks guitars, that viral video of the guy whose guitar was broken by the airplane company.
Yeah.
He turned it into an authentic expression, and the next thing you know, United is sponsoring him, and he's one of their spokespeople now.
Yeah.
Or viral videos that capture ideally something that truly happened, but they're appropriated. They're taken over for more commercial purposes than expressive purposes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a glutton for paradox and looking at things from many different sides, which makes me really have a good time as a director, because that's sort of my occupation, to look at everybody on the stage as working from their best intentions, even the villains. So in this case, I'm also a glutton for participating in the big discourse of culture. So I can't say that I can. I mean, the guy who does that song, and it gets, I can see it gets taken to viral levels and he gets a job out of it. And I think, fantastic, that is a great opportunity for him. And at the same time, I think, how unfortunate that things have to be turned into ads to sell things. But at the same time, I think, well, there's no villain here, because even the people doing the marketing are also people. I think the problem seems to be in corporate entities that no longer have, I mean, the whole invention of the corporation was to remove themselves from individual responsibility. That's the point. And I think that's always the tragedy when we get into corporate entities owning things and marketing things and selling things and turning things into things, is that there's no longer any person who is obligated to be responsible for whatever outcome happens. And that's where I think that disconnect is where we run the risk of losing all of our authority and power and potential for connection. That sounds like a vague thing that I'm saying, but that's my main feeling about corporations. It makes it impossible to say there's an enemy, because that corporation is a group of people, none of whom are evil.
It sounds like you're saying that incorporation strips away individual responsibility for collective actions, for instance, and thus removes the ability for authenticity within that expression or that activity.
And it has a double-edged sword, BP, the 25 years ago, the big spill, in the big problem in India. And is it Union Carbide? So it's a corporation, so nobody actually needs to be held responsible, and nobody will step up to the plate and be responsible. The missing ethical step, that there's some idea in our society that it's okay to avoid taking responsibility for things, getting away with things, right? And there's a whole idea around working with children, for example. If you say the phrase, "If you do that again, I'm going to do X." And what that is doing is preparing them to tolerate the consequences for their actions. You're asking them, if you can withstand the consequences for this behavior, then do it. And so that's when you get into a whole bunch of problems with, like, prison, incarceration. So people say, yeah, I can withstand 2 years in prison, so I'll do it, right? Whereas the argument needs to be, this is not moral. Your action is irresponsible. You need to take moral responsibility. That choice isn't good. And then you have people developing the ability to make ethical choices. And I think that has gotten very far away from the normal everyday activity. It starts off with a good idea, I think, of getting the church out of the state, so you don't have a God and a moral code that is inexorable, that is persecuting people. But the other end of the extreme is that nobody now has any... It's harder and harder to find people who believe that stepping up to moral responsibility is necessary. And in, the corporations are part of that formula.
And in individuals doing the math between their short-term gain and long-term suffering, the if I do this, commit this crime and achieve these wealths or benefits, but then have to go to jail for 2 years, it turns into a quantitative calculation as opposed to a qualitative one, much these contest shows. Again, it's quantitative considerations of talent and attention on individuals as opposed to qualitative weighing of individual expression.
Yeah.
So within this context then, wherein corporations are free to do whatever they will, so long as they're willing to suffer those consequences, wherein artists need to justify their existence in terms of ROI and bottom line, etc. What is the role of the actor or the theater in North American society right now?
I think that the role of theater, generally speaking, would be to engage feelings that the audience knows, that to engage feelings in the audience and opinions in the audience that they don't always have access to on a day-to-day basis. In some cases, those feelings are joy and euphoric, and that is called entertainment. And they don't have access to that on a regular basis. They work hard, they save their money, they buy the ticket, they enjoy, they have a fantastic time, they feel connection by laughing with hundreds of people or 20 people. They're connected and fed, and they have aspects of their psyche and emotional world that are enlivened. And in other cases, it's feelings of pain and suffering that are that catharsis, where there are things on the stage that are allowing them to feel things, and moving things through their bodies and bringing the tears out, or anger or emotions that they also don't have access to on a regular basis. And that's the function of art. It's not to educate, it's to engage things that are, I believe, are already there. Lots of spectrums of emotions. I think it's a very sensual endeavor. And that doesn't preclude intellectual endeavor, but there's a circuitry of soul and emotion and intellect that are all have to be flowing together for optimum humanity, in my opinion. That's the role, and it's live. Like and it will always be important. This story and the storyteller, the ultimate, you know, the basic ingredient of theater has always been around. It's predated religion, and it's now films are 3D. And I'm like, well, 3D films are us. That's what we do, to some degree. That's the same thing. I think that the technology. Like I don't have any. I think there's false dichotomies that are often set up between theater and new technologies, and it's a false one because the impulse to get on YouTube and make your own movie, that is the same impulse that makes a live theater event meaningful. Like the people who are auditioning for theater are also wanting to participate and engage in any form that's going to put them in contact with stories.
You spoke about theater and entertainment as a connection to other individuals. You said laughing with 100 people or laughing with even 20 people was an essential function of the entertaining aspect of theater. Do you think theater and performance and the expressive arts are necessarily social, or can they be experienced profoundly on an individual level as well?
Yeah, I think it can be really individual. But I think there is something that is distinct about watching a live performance in a room with other people. I say 100 or 20 because I know there's different sizes of theaters. They're all valid and important. I think it is a really individual experience as well. Like I know that there are people doing performances that are much more one-on-one or have earbuds or factors like that. But I think what they never seem to remove is the fact that you're going to go there and there'll be other people around you. And there'll be another person with you who's doing the performance, even if you're the only person in the audience or that's the construct for the performance. So, and I do think, like when I sit and watch a movie in a movie cinema, the feeling, there's a kind of different feeling, even though we're all in a room together, it's more like individuals are separated from each other. It's not bad, it's just different. It's a little more isolated because I think it's because there's nobody on the, there's not another living animal sort of on the stage in front of you. It has a different feeling qualitatively. And so even if it's in a very specific construct, one-on-one, there's a presence and electricity that comes from being with another person. And I think that is, that is kind of the basic premise of theater. I think it's really interesting now that people, they present productions in movie cinemas, like taped productions of theater. And I think there's probably greater or lesser success to that. I still think people are imagining that they're in the theater when they're watching it. I don't know. I think some of them don't succeed because they become compared with film and they're emulating film and they don't make good movies. But I think they do succeed when people are actually imagining that they're live. That's my gambit. I don't know.
It is an interesting gamble that the theater companies are undertaking, and makes one wonder about their motivation if people have stopped going to movies or aren't going, and why that would be. Are they're too busy with the 4-inch screen in front of them instead of the 40-foot screen that they could go see, or even theater performances?
People have this notion that owning things is better than anything else, and I think it's pretty intense, that ideology. Like, it is persistent. It's the propaganda of advertising all around us. But I just don't think it's gonna have to reach its max. I mean, there's big issues in the States with people having so many consumer goods that they're putting them in storage units. Like, it's another face of obesity. It's another face of this hunger. It's an insatiable, bottomless pit that objects or food are supposed to fill. I think they can only be filled by connection with other humans. And I believe in humanity's ability to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, I think we're going through versions of this all the time. War is a factor of it too, you know?
That's an interesting point about consumption. Yesterday on the news, there was a piece saying, it was a business reporter was saying that last year in Canada, more BMW 3 Series were sold than Honda Accords, which is interesting because Honda Accords are the family car, right? And BMW, one thinks of as an aspirational brand.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like no one's ever satisfied with what's standard anymore. Everyone has to be above average. We're all above average, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like this constant climbing or pursuit of more, whether it's more sweetness, more gadgets, more luxury, suggests a deep dissatisfaction with what we do have and what we are experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there is a role for the theater in some means or another to address that?
Yeah, I think it does. I think, you know, we were talking about radio when we were walking up the stairs to the studio, that there's a level of intimacy, like reading a book. And I think that is part of what theater can engender, even if it's a kind of intimacy of being in a room with a bunch of strangers that you're sitting side by side, but you're laughing with them. That means you get it, or you're reacting, or you're clapping at the same time. Whatever it is, you get it. Somebody, you and somebody you don't know before, are in the same river, and you're catapulted into this stream together or this river together, and there is something nourishing about it, or enraging, because sometimes it's really, you know, frustrating or whatever, but it gives you some emotional connection, and that's live performance, and that's being together in a room in some capacity. I think it does do that.
In the press release announcing your appointment to the position of director of the National Theatre School's English section, it says your, quote, clearly articulated and all-encompassing vision for the future of the National Theatre School made you the obvious choice to lead the English section into its next phase of growth and accomplishment. Would you describe that vision and how you intend to pursue it?
Is it all-encompassing?
All-encompassing. That's right.
Well, as you can tell from our sort of eclectic conversation, I like the world that I live in, and I like to examine a lot of it. And I have Catholic tastes in the old sense of the word Catholic, meaning eclectic, basically. That was one of the best branding ideas in the world, was to call a religion Catholic, which means you encompass a lot of different things. So talk about inviting co-opting. Just saying, with all the Pope news, that's my thought on religion today. Now back to the all-encompassing. Yes. Well, perhaps what they're talking about is like a reflection of the kind of training that I had. I have a lot of curiosity for how things belong together and the connections amongst things. So my belief about theater is that there are many different styles, and I actually strongly feel like many of them are, I believe many of them are, they're all valuable. Large commercial productions have some value, as do the small devised creations, solo shows. That's reflected in my work. It's quite sincere. I've directed, I was the resident director of Lord of the Rings, which was at that time the largest English language production in the history of the world. I think it's been outstripped now by Spider-Man or something. But
is that show still on? I thought they killed three people in their cast. And
yeah,
so they
found a way to, there's somebody was willing to step into the shoes, and they probably got the safety standards up or something like that. Yes, it's still going on. I think there's still a lawsuit between Julie Taymor and Bono and who knows who else. But so I worked on that. I have a one-person show that Haley McGee is touring around the world that has a suitcase, her and a suitcase. So my taste is sincerely broad. New creations, Canadian work, classics, the whole thing, all kinds of people coming together. So that's one way when I'm looking at the training for theater, I'm not purveying a particular style. What I believe is that a well-trained actor or theater artist, somebody who's got a fantastic mix of technique, self-awareness, and talent, curiosity, appetite, that combo. Somebody who's well-trained in those ways can go and apply themselves to any style of theater that they are drawn to. And in a long career, somebody might start with the classics and end up by writing their own shows, or vice versa, or who knows what. There's a long arc possible. It can encompass a lot of growth. So that's my paradigm. And I also believe this is a really great moment to lead with Canadian theater and to have theater artists in Canada begin their studies by recognizing the breadth and diversity of Canadian theater as a launching pad. This is a perfect moment. We've got just enough material to launch us into the classics and launch us into the future via our own body of work.
You've said, quote, "I'm interested in breaking down the solitudes in our culture, our Canadian culture, and the split between English and French traditions." I'll continue the quote after that interlude. "The future of National Theatre School can involve the creation of a meaningful bridge between the French and English sections. As a bilingual artist, I'd like to build that bridge over the next few years, both in the dialogue at a leadership level and by creating a richer and more authentic exchange among the students." Would you explain why you think this is important not only to the school, but also to Canadian English and French culture, and how you expect it'll influence that national culture of parallel solitudes?
Well, one of the things that I would want to expand on is that the solitudes aren't just two. It isn't just English and French, although that wasn't explicit in this particular quote. But part of what I'm interested in is there are many solitudes. There's Aboriginal artists and a population, and there's French and English, there's new Canadians. I actually speak three languages. My mother's Cuban. I speak Spanish. So there's second, third, fourth generation Canadians. There's a lot of solitudes. And Toronto is a great city for me to have lived in for the past 20 years because there's a very unique creative mix where people have an affirmation of their distinct cultures and also a really dynamic exchange. Downtown, fantastic, love Toronto. And it's a beautiful emblem for me of a lot of the things I love about Canada. So there's a lot of solitudes that I think can be brought together. When I was talking about Canadian theater, that's one of the reasons why I want to lead with that, because there's an incredible diversity. Like in the first month of training, I've got artists like Janet Sears and Thompson Highway who are going to come in and talk about their plays, their fantastic plays like Harlem Duet and the Rez Sisters. Why did they create what they did? What was going on at the time they wrote it? Who are they now? These are both plays that at one time were radical. They're rooted in One was rooted in Shakespeare, the other one's rooted in trickster storytelling tradition. So they go right down into the history of our art, and they go right into the future because they represented really intense voices talking about race, class, gender, Canadian, everything, American, international, the whole thing. They're incredible pieces. Those are just a couple of examples, right? So there's a lot of solitudes that can be that are already in dialogue with each other, and I want to affirm how much we've already accomplished as a country. And in terms of the French and English, my impression is, my knowledge is that the French section of the theater school and the Quebec culture, they have a very vibrant art form, and they have really nurtured strong audience affirmation for culture. They have been arguing for very successfully for the centrality of culture as part of their identity. And I think that is really good timing for Anglophone artists to hear that. It's unapologetic, and I know it's not easy, but it's a face of Quebec nationalism that is incredibly inspiring to me. And there's also techniques and ways of doing theater that I think that I studied and learned from, and that are really, that going back to the beginning of the conversation, that made me quite an exotic Anglophone. And they have a really beautiful section that's functioning wonderfully. And the artists that I've met who are running the French section, Denise Guilbeault, Robert Bellefeuille, many, many others, they know what they're doing over there. They have a lot of experience. And the more exchange I have, I can benefit enormously as a new person in the school from their generosity and their inspiration. And the students, it's unique. The National Theatre School is unique in a lot of ways. And one of them is that it's in Montreal. And Montreal is... got a lot of languages and a lot of life, and knowing that the students are going to invest their time and their money into a place like that, one of the riches to mine is this exchange with a culture that is at once foreign and at once intimately Canadian and deeply Canadian. So they can be outsiders and insiders all at the same time. The Anglophone in Montreal is both those things.
I can see how this vision would be described as all-encompassing. Now, you've said that the National Theatre School, you intend to provide leadership that will create a vessel steady enough to hold the vagaries of personal and artistic growth. Would you tease that out a little bit, please?
Oh, yeah. In some ways, that's very straightforward. When I've been, for me, anyway, it feels, when I go to rehearse a play, one of the things that I find very, very helpful is for me to understand how I want to use time and how I want to use space, those ingredients that are non-negotiable, really. And so what I'm trying to do is understand how to use the non-negotiable ingredients to create an environment where the actor can come in and be relaxed, because they know what's coming next to some degree. They know that there's a schedule and a structure and someone who's taking care of all that, and they can come in and do and be available to the muse. Because that's my goal in creating a rehearsal hall, is to make enough structure so that all of us as artists can be available to whatever comes at us, diving into the work, not having to worry about the pragmatics. You have to be able to forget about those things and be in a state of sort of psychic and spiritual relaxation. So then the chaos and the suffering and the euphoria, all those things that are going to happen anyway, they happen in the right place, which is in the rehearsal hall, doing the work. So in terms of the school, organizing a schedule, the mundane, the apparently mundane things like what's coming next, what's the time frame, routine, a certain amount of repetition, you train for a marathon, you do things in a certain order, then you start to relax, because then things are going to come at you that you can't control, like this kind of work or that kind of character or this kind of idea. That's what I mean.
So the creative arts being necessarily personally expressive by and of an individual artist runs kind of counter to artistic traditions or artistic conventions, schools of thought, which are more or less codified set of rules and boundaries for that expression. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile those tensions then? Or where do you find or strike a balance between freewheeling individual expression on the one hand and the conventions and strictures of schools of thought on the other?
Well, it's very apt, because that tension, I don't want to reconcile them. I actually want to exploit them or mine them. And that's where the self-awareness of the artist comes from. When I talk to my students and introducing myself to them and getting to know them, I tell them as transparently as I can, I'm making rules and structure and organization and standards, and you're in an organization. And at the same time, by nature, you need to be pursuing something that is uncontrollable, something that is a fire within you, or an appetite, or a level of discomfort, or chaos, who knows what, whole bunch of things that are not suited to being tamed. And I've asked them to be aware of the level of discomfort. They should feel some discomfort. They should bridle. They should either feel overwhelmed or resentful. The things that people do when they're living in a house, you know, when I was a teenager and growing up, you know, I'm angry, and I have the privilege of feeling safe enough to be angry about the rules that are imposed on me. So I'm asking the students to be aware of their discomfort, and there's a level of discomfort. When it gets to be too much, it's going to interfere with their growth and their ability to learn and do their work and succeed. But if there's just enough of that frustration, they need to figure out what it is. That's how they can be aware of their process. And they need to mind that, because that tension is where there's so much power. Do you know what I mean? Like training a muscle, right? You do repetition, exercises, all these things. There's a certain amount of discomfort involved in it. And then your body learns it, and then you excel in the expression of it, and you're no longer in the pain of learning the steps. But there's a necessary kind of tension between freedom and training.
And that interaction then between training and individual expression allows room for the individual to influence the tradition then.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
What place do you see for the National Theatre School in influencing the artistic and theatrical tradition in Canada?
That's one of the most optimistic, hopeful guiding lights in the whole thing. Because by embarking on a training program that I feel is going to be very, very rigorous and demanding, I think, and by opening up a dialogue with the students about, you know, be aware of what you're doing. I'm not looking for compliance. I'm not looking for obedience or compliance for the sake of it. I'm looking for the work. That in opening up this dialogue and putting that on the table, then I'm going to hear from them. Like, I'm kind of asking for trouble, right? Because I'm going to hear from them when there's something that is difficult in the wrong way, or not difficult enough, or leading them into something that where they're repeating something and they need something fresh. And so I'm prepared to be listening to the frustrations when they get to be too much and shaping in response to that. So that's how I feel like I'll be led towards the new ideas, by setting something in motion that is based on a technique and traditions. And in some cases, I'm also balancing out very old school classical stuff with training in creation-based work and working with artists that are very, very young and very, very new. So I have a spectrum of teachers and mentors and leaders who are everywhere from 24 years old to, I'm hoping, 80. And a big spectrum of life experience and approach to theater. That's another way that I'm thinking I'll be able to see where the really deep new ideas that are deeply rooted, where they're going to come from. So
over the past 2 minutes, your gestures have become bigger and bolder and more expressive. It seems like a challenge that you're very excited about.
Yeah, I am really excited about it. I don't know what the future holds. I know that sounds like that's obvious. But I am excited about it. I'm afraid too, you know. I have very high expectations for myself, and I apply that to so many people that work with me, and I work with people with such high standards at the school. And so I feel like when I say I'm afraid, I feel like I'm really going to the edge of the cliff, and it's exhilarating. Like an opportunity like this for me to step into this role is exhilarating, because I'm working with if I've ever wanted to make connections amongst things, this is an opportunity and a platform for me to do so. But I'm going to the edge of everything that I can. But luckily I can do it because there's so many, it's a very stable organization. It's incredibly strong.
The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through ciut.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again.
I can sense the restlessness pacing alongside pollinated roads. Amongst all this talk about the transfer of control, who is responsible for this debacle? Can the empire topple? Will it provide me with the opportunity to do the unlawful? You see, I've got big plans for advancement, and I'll take my chances with any sudden burst of anarchy. If it's interspersed sparsely with escape routes, I've got to get my family safe and out. This may be the only open door, at least that's what we're hoping for. There's an entire realm of possibilities that I'm ready to explore. Ready to breach the wall, watch the most prominent of oppressors fall. The constant longing erupts into an alarm of new day dawning. Time to heed the judgment call, leave behind the Neanderthal. Kiss my crops and chickens, bless the homestead, will be missing. Wrap my rations, one more roll in the sack with the heat of passion. I hear rifles in the distance. The reckoning beckons, this is where control of history changes hands in a matter of seconds. So let's stand the aggression, a humble people turn liberation junkie, makes their point known bluntly, bring fire to the oppressors for what they've done to the beloved native country. What remains between me and my freedom is their ability to hunt me, so bring it on. I promise you I'll sing it on steps with topple columns, forever dedicated to the opposite of autumn. We circumvent the entire border in the name of peaceful order, to memorialize the start of the second quarter, once the guard changed. Can you tell me, has the guard changed? Can you tell me, has the guard changed? Pardon me.
I am dead, thou livest. Report me and my cause aright to the unsatisfied. Oh, good Horatio, what a wounded name. Things standing thus unknown shall live behind me, if thou didst ever hold me in thy heart. Absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world, draw thy breath in pain to tell my story.
Gotta hide my daughter from the stormtroopers, looking for a life to sacrifice. I might meddle as a refugee, regretfully, and leave behind my lack of rights. When they limit the perimeter, things get a little sinister, but you gotta look towards the light, so use all your might. And you may have to wiggle a bit, but when you get a grip, hold it tight. This is the only fight that matters, and it could be disastrous. Instruments of war spray the pacifist, so I were better off blasphemous. There is no detaching this heavy heart. And now that they've let me start, the 20-minute lead bleeds the three. I breathe behind a tree and look behind me easily. Continue with the exodus feverishly. Hide under
under a sink in the infirmary, and instead the troops search the nursery. Work the kings in uncertainty, living in a madhouse state of emergency. Fast forward back to slow motion, so surreal with no obvious notion. We are not free for real until they break the seal and reconcile with these vile devotions. Revolution is watching something bloom, generate when you ventilate and consume. When the explosion filled the room, steel shielded the impact, real and intact. Walked to the front and through the doors back, finally felt like home to be here. The resemblance to spring was so clear, realized there was nothing to fear.